Podcast, Series 3, Episode 8. Where does the time go?
It's almost summer. Almost summer.
Yeah. Well, anyway, the next 45 minutes is going to go on Linux and free software and podcasting, because it's time for Linux Voice, Series 3, Episode 8. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Graham Morrison.
And I'm Mike Saunders.
And in this fun-packed, anarchic sound wave, I apologise.
My brain's been fried by political thoughts of nightmarish Orwellian visions all week. I'm sorry.
You're not alone, Graham. Actually, maybe you are, because you live in the south.
Yeah, anyway, I live in England. You guys live in Scotland now.
Anyway, we've got some free software in Linux news. We've got a voice of the masses. We may have some brains to speak. Mm-hmm. We've also got our finds, which are going to be extra special this fortnight for no reason at all.
Oh well, some of them come from Scotland. Yeah. They genuinely do come from Scotland.
Oh yeah, of course.
So a little bit special.
A special poster independence. Yeah. Right, I think we've ramped up the excitement to fever pitch. We can get on with the news. But where's Ben?
Yes, Ben is not here. Ben is in Scotland this episode for whatever reason. So I have seized control of the news section. I have taken over, and I'll see if I can do it as good as Ben. I won't be able to categorise things quite as well. He's got a great knack for that. But let's kick off with some Raspberry Pi news. The Raspberry Pi B+ model has had its price dropped to just $25 now. The foundation has explained this with a side effect of the production optimizations that allowed us to hit the $35 target price for the Raspberry Pi 2 is that with the model B+, it's now much cheaper to manufacture than when it was introduced. With this in mind, we've decided to drop its list price to $25. If you're looking for a Pi with networking and multiple USB ports and don't need the extra performance or memory that the Raspberry Pi 2 brings, you might want to check it out.
That is great, isn't it? It's brilliant that there's still a market for the B+. I remember when Ben and I talked to Eben that they're part of that. He said the demand for the B+ he thought was unlikely to diminish because there were so many products and things built and being built around that, the form factor and the known specification. So the fact that it's even cheaper is like that's a huge chunk off, really. If Apple did the same thing to their Macs, everyone would be like, "Hey,
yeah." I mean that brings it even more into the sort of disposable category, doesn't it? There's lots of people talk about what made the Pi so successful, the community, the software, you know, having a full Linux stack. But yeah, $25, you know, you can put it in so many different projects, and if it does break, it's not the end of the world.
Yeah.
There are other cheap single board computers out there, and the market is becoming more competitive now. So as we'll see a bit later on in the news with another board. Even though the Pi 2 is out now and is considerably more powerful, I'm sure there are going to be loads of people still using the lower spec models.
I wonder if that means the A+ as well. I was just going to Google it. The A+ will come down in price because I think that was the old price for the A+.
I haven't seen a mention of that. Yeah. But yeah, if that goes down in price as well, then...
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And I think it's surprising. I think... Another interesting thing is that there hasn't actually been anything to come along and compete with the Raspberry Pi for price in these past 3 years or 2.5 years. You know, it's a very, very difficult feat, a trick to pull off.
Sorry, Graham, what's the thing that I saw that was this new $9 computer?
That's something we're going to talk about later in the news.
Oh, well, yeah, okay. we could even seg into the next news story.
Ah,
What would Ben do?
What would Ben do? Ben, send us your brainwaves. All right. So, in true Ben tradition, I'll say, on the topic of single board computers, we have now Chip, the world's first $9 computer. This is a Kickstarter project that a bunch of developers have set up. They wanted to reach $50,000 US, and at the time of this podcast, with 22 days to go, they'd reached $1.2 million.
Whoa.
I mean, like, whoa.
It looks amazing as well. It does look really good. I am quite excited by it.
Same here. I can see why. I can see why they've raised so much money, because it's like it's the same buzz as the Raspberry Pi all over again.
Yeah.
So this is a very tiny board. It has a 1 gigahertz CPU, 512 megs of RAM, and 4 gigabytes of storage. They're not USB ports, as far as I can see. It's got Wi-Fi and Bluetooth to connect to the internet and keyboard and mouse. And also for video output, it's composite.
There's an HDMI add-on, yeah.
Yeah. So on the one hand, this is fantastic for $9 if they can really achieve that. On the other hand, for a lot of us, we'd have to buy quite a few add-ons to you know, I don't have any Bluetooth mice or keyboard, you know. And,
yeah.
But one thing that slightly concerns me is the Kickstarter talks a lot about using LibreOffice and Chromium, and they talk about how you can install GIMP and stuff. But LibreOffice and browsing on the original Raspberry Pis was not a pleasant experience.
No, but it wasn't impossible, and this is slightly faster.
So yeah,
it is. I mean, I think in their video they show some LibreOffice working. It's not what I would choose to do with it. And you know, I've got a couple of Raspberry Pis around the house, and they're not connected to USB anything, and they're not connected to screens. So the fact that there's like a really $9 computer, you know, with basically the same kind of power, I think is brilliant.
Oh, absolutely. I think it will be fantastic for a lot of the jobs that the Pi does, but for even cheaper and even more disposable. Yeah, I was just curious when they talk about things like office work, because it's not going to be a very pleasant experience.
It's interesting that people always try and push that aspect of these small computers, because it's not... Is it what gets everybody excited? Is it what all the backers are going to do?
Yeah, I guess everybody wants this sort of... has this dream of, oh, the super cheap computer that can do everything. But I think it's better to be honest. This will be great for like Internet of Things and scattering around your house, connecting to a media server and stuff. And it does come preloaded with Scratch to teach programming.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's really, really good.
And even, I think the $19 option comes with a battery, a LiPo battery pack that gives it some like five hours battery life. And it's those batteries are tiny. They're like little shuttle batteries. So the whole package, you know, it's just brilliant.
Oh, I'll have to check that out, because I recently got a quadcopter, a SEMA X5C.
Really?
Yeah. And I've only been really flying it around indoors at the moment. I mean to go out to the English Garden at some point and fly it around and probably get arrested. But I'd like to add some stuff onto it. It has to be very, very light. But maybe one of these chip things with its tiny battery.
Yeah.
I don't know what I could do with it. But
does it run Linux, your quadcopter?
No, it's pretty limited, but it can it's got a high HD video camera built into it.
Oh.
You just pop a micro SD card in the back, and you can fly it up to about 100 meter range. So yeah, I want to get out in the countryside and film some mountain panoramas. Moving on to Mozilla. Let's have some Mozilla related news. They are now offering downloads of the Firefox browser with Adobe's CDM. That's their content decryption module for playing DRM content, also digital restrictions management content, as the Free Software Foundation would say. So this will allow you to watch videos from certain sites where they don't want anybody to copy it. Mozilla actually says, "We are enabling DRM in order to provide our users with the features they require in a browser and allow them to continue accessing premium video content. We don't believe DRM is a desirable market solution, but it's currently the only way to watch a sought-after segment of content."
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Ben and I had a long discussion kind of argument about this last year, where in fact he was much more pragmatic and thought that, you know, this was a good thing. It meant that people wouldn't migrate away from Firefox to other browsers, where I was a bit more idealistic about it, thinking, well, I still feel very strongly, you know, that Tim Berners-Lee created the internet. The idea was that it was open and accessible to everyone. It's gone crazy anyway, the fact that, you know, everything is built around insane CSS and we're losing a focus on accessibility and making it available to everybody. And I understand what they're trying to do, but I don't think Mozilla should be going after the most users market. I think it should be going after sticking to the standards and trying to make sure the standards remain relevant.
Yeah, do they lead or do they follow? They are still making available a Firefox download without this or without access to it. So if you really dislike DRM, like pretty much most of us in the Linux world, then you know, as long as I can steer completely clear of all this nonsense, because I'm really not that bothered. I think paying for content is important.
And I use Netflix. Now I openly use Netflix. So you know, that's DRM content delivered, you know, through a, you know, proprietary software.
Yeah,
and it's just the browser is such a fundamental part, and I think this erodes it. Well, they've got a difficult task. Do they become irrelevant, or do they stand for openness? And I think it's also important, if you remember 10 years ago in Linux, we couldn't even access our banks through our browsers.
Yeah.
Things were so skewed towards you need Internet Explorer 3 to access this site. It happened everywhere. It was crippling. And I just don't want that to happen again. Which I think this is like the first step in a long road to that final destination.
Yeah, the other day I was trying to access a PDF form from the adult schooling thing in Munich, and I loaded it up and it said, you need to run this in Adobe Reader. So I got Adobe Reader, and it was a 125 megabyte download just so I could open this PDF. And yeah, this is not the way we want to be going. DRM doesn't work. People will find ways to copy anyway. You can screen scrape and snatch audio and a million other things.
Yeah, and in a way, this is Mozilla kind of vindicating that. DRM does have a place. But no, it's just an insane, you know, it's just a numbers game for the bureaucrats that come up with this system.
Yeah, and being against DRM doesn't mean you're in favour of copyright, violating copyright. We offer DRM-free PDFs in our magazine. We don't want people handing them out freely, you know. We rely on people buying subscriptions, but we don't put DRM on because it's rubbish.
Yeah. Anywho. So, I mean, Ben always offers a very good other side of the argument, and he has got a very good point, and I can understand why they're making this decision, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we'll see in the long run. They probably see Chrome and Chromium's, you know, massively accelerating market share.
Yeah, Chrome is a threat, but what can you do? I don't know.
And the final news section this month is a certain Linux magazine has announced its first yearly profit donation scheme. That was Linux Voice, funnily enough. When we did our crowdfunding campaign back in 2013, we said that we'd give 50% of our yearly profits back to the community. That has now happened because we've spent the last year getting the magazine in newsagents and all around the world.
I don't think anybody really makes a profit in the first year, but we did have some money spare.
We did, yeah. We still have £3,000 to give around. And so in issue 13, we asked our readers to vote, which was a while ago, but we had to wait for the issue to get all around to Australia and Uzbekistan and all those other places. The readers voted and we have the results. This is where possibly, Graham, you could put a drum roll in or something. I'm sure you have that in your collection of public domain sound effects.
Could it be like electro drums, you know, like boo, 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 boo?
Even better, yeah. Use your creative freedom here. So,
can Mike be opening up gold envelopes and wearing an evening dress? Please.
So,
okay, let's open the envelope.
Ta-da! In the software category, first place is Scribus.
Wow, who starts with first place? Who starts with first place?
Oh, yeah, okay.
Come on.
This is clearly not a career move for me. In software category, in third place, Inkscape receives £200. Second place, the GIMP receives £300. And in first place, Scribus receives a whopping £1,000.
Awesome.
That was the software category. Excellent. And Craig Bradney, lead developer of Scribus, told us, I'd like to thank all the readers of Linux Voice magazine, as well as all the users of Scribus out there. These kinds of funds go well towards allowing the team to meet up and collaborate on features and bug resolution. The best example is the Libre Graphics meeting, which has just happened in Toronto, which was the 10th anniversary of this meeting, where Scribus has been represented every year, and we've always had a good meeting there. And he says that the 1.5 version is due out very soon. And yeah, our funds should go towards improving that, fixing bugs and helping them to meet. Then in the projects and distros category, in third place, the Free Software Foundation gets £200. In second place, the Electronic Frontier Foundation gets £300. And in first place, the Open Rights Group gets £1,000. And Jim Killock, the executive director of the Open Rights Group, told us, "We are really grateful to all of the readers who voted for the Open Rights Group. We are going to use the money to print our report into surveillance by GCHQ and send copies to every new MP so they can understand how privacy, free speech and the security of the internet is being threatened by our own government agencies. This will give us an early start in challenging any new intrusive legislation proposed by the new government." Which, funnily enough,
they haven't wasted any time.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was about 3 seconds into the Tories getting a majority, they announced
on the exit poll. It was just straight after the exit poll.
Yeah, they've announced that they can now push through all their lovely anti-terrorist, so-called anti-terrorist legislation without those evil Lib Dems thinking about our rights and privacy. So, yeah, it looks like it's going to get terribly worse in the UK now. So hopefully the Open Rights Group can tell these MPs why they're wrong.
Absolutely fantastic. I get a really warm feeling from this.
Yeah, me too.
And if you've subscribed to the magazine or listened to the podcast, then you've played your part in this as well. So you should feel warm too.
Yeah, it just wouldn't have happened, you know. It's great that they're doing something specific with the money. That feels that feels good, doesn't it? You know, those letters are down to, you know, the readers and the listeners and everything. Genuinely, that feels good.
Yep, exactly. So that's all the news. If you're listening, Ben, I hope I represented you well.
I think you did a great job, Mike. Okay, so let's move on to finds of the fortnight and one day. I did ask the IRC channel. It's pretty quiet over there, and I didn't give anyone much notice. In fact, when I said this, Ian Norm said, apart from the fact that the current government is building the framework for a new Uber Stasi state. This is... but he does go on to say, perhaps a little related but tenuous, I got given a quadcopter drone for my birthday last week that fits in the palm of my hand, and you can get them for £10 or £15 on Amazon. It's awesome, apart from the battery lasting only 5 minutes. And it's called the CX-10. So if you're interested in being an informer, it's cheap to do so. any finds?
I've got some finds. Hopefully I can link two of them together in the manner of Ben. So first find. Last Sunday, I went to the Yorkshire Wildlife Park. And it was great. They've got polar bears and lions and other animals that aren't as cool as polar bears and lions. You know, meerkats and stuff like that. And there were lions, like, they were play fighting, right, just a few metres away from us. It felt fantastic. It felt a bit like being in Jurassic Park. You know, I had the theme tune running through my head and thinking, what if the lions learned to, you know, drive a car. And then that made me think of another discovery, which is that when she sits down at the computer and says, oh, this is Unix, I know how this works, there's that ridiculously, you know, fake looking file system that's like, you know, like it represents all of the folders in the file system and the security system and Jurassic Park Island as little 3D boxes. And I'd always thought that was just some, you know, daftery made up for the film. But actually, according to Graham, in a great feature, which is forthcoming in the next edition of Linux Voice, that was real software.
Yeah, running on the Silicon Graphics machine. And for that feature, this is why it takes me so long to do things. I compiled the code and got it running on Arch.
Really? Yeah. That's commitment. That's journalism, ladies and gentlemen.
So the screenshot is really from my Arch machine.
If you're going to do really hard stuff like that, you should mention it in the words. Make yourself look really lazy.
Well, it's probably just an app getting in Ubuntu, so, you know, you don't want to make it scare people off. Yeah. It had a few weird dependencies. Someone had ported it to Linux like 15 years ago. It had a few old dependencies, some old version of GCC libs, but it ran and it's actually really good.
It might make a good video of that, actually.
Yeah.
Running on Linux and yeah.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we could get someone to dress up as a velociraptor. Oh, that's all about the dressing up today. My other discovery is a politics-based discovery, so I think I'll just forget that one. I think we've all just had enough.
I've done quite a bit of messing around with Linux just this last week. I spent some time sorting out remote controls in Kodi, which I used. I've got a small ARM Linux box, silent, that plugged into the television. It's absolutely brilliant as a Kodi front end, XBMC front end. It runs brilliantly. It's perfect. And as I wrote about, I think, in the Open Elect tutorial in Linux Voice a few months ago, you can have user accounts so the kids have access to their collection of movies and we've got access to all the rest. And actually, the movies are all recorded on another small ARM box running TV head end and connected to a satellite feed. So it's just that's recording stuff and dumping it into the right folders. And I spent some time sorting out the proper remote controls for it. Configuring open remote controls in OpenELEC is a real pain. But what I did spend some time doing is setting up, cutting out adverts and the bit before the programs start on television. And you don't have to, one of my discoveries is you don't have to open these up into video editors. You can create what's called as an edit decision list, an EDL. And this is basically a text file that you put in the same place as your video file. And in the text file, you put the time and the frame of where you want bits to be cut out. And when Kodi or XBMC gets around to playing it, it'll just skip the adverts or skip straight to when the movie starts, which is really useful.
That's cool.
And you don't have to go through the movies and create these things manually. If you watch an MPlayer, for example, on a Linux desktop, there's a shortcut that you can assign to create the EDL from the positions that you're in. So you just skip through it, press a button, it creates an edit point for that, skip through again, cut the adverts out. That's really quick. And there's also, I haven't used it yet, but I'm thinking of writing a tutorial on it, a command line tool for actually going, it's taken from Myth TV. It goes through all of the movie and detects the blank frames that are used to sometimes show where adverts are positioned so that it'll automatically take out adverts and leave the main thing intact. And all of that's kind of offline, so the EDLs don't edit the movies themselves, although you can do that. They just allow Kodi to skip through all those parts. And then another discovery is that I updated Steam. I hadn't done it for ages because I hadn't any time playing games and it keeps crashing. And I needed to know if it was accessing the network. And there's lots of tools for monitoring the networks and processes. NTOP comes to mind. But a really friendly curses-based one is called NetHogs. And it's a bit like TOP, but for processes and how much network bandwidth they're using. So you just run NetHogs. You have to put an interface as an argument, I think, and then you know the processes like Steam client or XBMC or Firefox start bouncing around just as they do on top. With on the right hand columns, it shows you how much bandwidth they're using per second and how much they've downloaded and uploaded over the time you've been running it. It's a really useful quick utility to see what's happening on your system.
Does sound great.
Yeah.
Is it available in most like repos? Is it really obscure tool that you have to always compile?
I can't imagine it's that obscure, but it was in the AUR in Arch, so it could be It could be really obscure or it could be common. But I'd never come across it before. I've installed NTOP before, which is really powerful. It runs in a daemon and it just runs in the background and you access it through a web portal. But this is just like TOP. You just need to use it to see if you're interested to see what's using your bandwidth. They're my finds.
Awesome. Well, I've got two, a non-Linux one and a Linux one. I'll start with a non-Linux one, and that is Eisenach, the city in Thuringia in former East Germany. It's not really a find because I knew that it existed before, but I went to visit it. And it's actually hardly anybody goes there, loads of people asking me, like, why do you speak German? Why have you come here? And stuff. Everybody was really friendly, but it's known as the place where Martin Luther, in a big castle on a hill, translated the New Testament into German. And it's the place where Johann Sebastian Bach was born as well.
Yeah, it all makes sense. But Mike, you're a fan of Bach, aren't you?
I am. I have this constant battle between who is the best person in the history of the world. Is it Bach or David Braben or Jackie Chan? You know, life is tough working these things out. But
the only time Mike ever wanted to get a synthesizer working on his Linux machine was when he wanted to get a huge harpsichord sound font playing on his desktop.
I remember that now.
So yeah. You could play Bach MIDI files with a proper harpsichord sound.
Ah, the good old days, yeah. Anyway, yeah, it's a really nice city. But what I saw as well was I was walking past a shop and I saw some prices for property nearby. And I saw a house.
A
three-bedroom house in a village near a spa town nearby for 35,000 euros. So that's 25,000 pounds. Okay, this is former East Germany, and there are some issues there with like a brain drain of younger people leaving and stuff. But I investigated more, and it's not like a bad area or anything. It's just the prices.
And if you moved there, you'd pretty much single-handedly reverse all of that brain drain, you know.
for skills in assembly programming and Mario Kart, yeah, perhaps. But it's just bonkers. I looked at other stuff around there as well, and yeah, especially compared to Munich prices, which are ridiculous. It's like, I mean, you've said something similar about France, haven't you, Graham? You can get huge properties in rural places for...
Well, yeah, maybe it's slightly different in France there, but also in large parts of Europe, as you know, over 50% of the population will rent, and they'll rent their whole life. They haven't got the same, you know, my home is my castle attitude that a lot of people have in the United Kingdom. But in France, it's in terms of area and landmass, it's much bigger than the UK. So the rural areas are much more rural. And if you grow up and you want to do something interesting, well, at least before the advent of the internet, you've got to go into a city. So in rural areas, you can get farms for 50 or 60,000 euros. But you'll never be able to sell it. I mean, the market in France is pretty dire, especially at the moment.
Well, I guess that's the other side of it. It's quite tempting to think, oh, well, buy up this house for £25,000 in Thuringia, and then, you know, see what price it will be in 10, 20 years. But
then, you know, that's not far off getting 3 or 4 years worth of rent. So if you live there for 3 or 4 years, you basically got the house for free.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, again, comparing to the big cities or places like
Andrew's
UK.
Shaking his head.
Let's all go and live in Thuringia.
Yeah.
It makes me so sad.
Oh, yeah, and my Linux-related find, to keep the podcast remotely on topic, I found a way to enter a command and not have it stored in your bash history. Does anybody else know how you do this?
Type clear afterwards?
No, that would just clear the screen, won't it?
Yeah. And there is a... Yeah, yeah. Remove...
All you... Yeah. I like the way you're getting increasingly complicated here. Hold down system rec backspace print screen. No, you simply put a space before the command.
Oh, really?
Yeah, if you put a space and then type your command, ls or whatever, and hit the up arrow key afterwards, it won't be there. Ah. It simply removes it from your history. So next time you've hacked at somebody's box and you're entering lots of commands and don't want them to see what you've done, just put spaces before them. It certainly worked on Ubuntu 14.10 that I was running. Although it does lead me to wonder then if that is a bug in Bash, you know, a sort of unintentional feature.
Yeah, yeah.
Or if it is actually deliberate and a sort of proper official way of not storing commands. I'll have to poke around in the code and find out.
Yeah, yeah. And before we move on, we've actually got a find from Ben. He's sent his audio files over from Scotland, so let's hear what he's got to say.
I have a trio of finds this fortnight. Actually, one of them's not really a find, but we'll start with that one. Last podcast, I posed a logic puzzle called Blue Eyes. I won't go through it all here, but I will say that Mark Williams has got it correct, and he's put his answer in the comments section of the last podcast. So if you're struggling with it, go and have a look at that, and that should explain it. There's also a solution, the same solution, explained a little bit differently at xkcd.com/solution.html. Okay, onwards with new finds. The first thing I found this fortnight is that Neil McGovern, the new Debian project lead, is a really nice guy. We met up from in Cambridge, and I don't actually use Debian myself, but I do use a number of Debian-based distros, and I feel safe in the knowledge that the project's in his hands. My second find this fortnight is a series of Bash shortcuts. There's quite a few, and some of them are more useful than others. A lot of them you can use other key combinations for on most keyboards. But the ones I found quite useful are Alt-Delete, which deletes the word before the cursor, Alt-D, which deletes the entire word after the cursor, Alt-T swaps the last two words around, and Control-T swaps the last two letters around. So this is all in a single line. It doesn't go back and change the history or anything like that. It just affects the line you're typing, which is quite handy if, like me, you're terrible at typing commands correctly the first time. Those are my finds this fortnight.
Thanks, Ben. Ah, great finds. Good section, everyone.
This feels like a good time to mention that if you like DRM-free PDFs, and if you like the idea of supporting free software projects such as Scribus and GIMP and the Open Rights Group, you can do so by subscribing to Linux Voice at shop.linuxvoice.com. There we go.
Awesome.
Which leads us on to my favourite section of the podcast, which is vocalise your neurons. And yet some episodes we get no neurons, and this episode we've had quite a few.
Wow. So it's funny the way the world works, isn't it?
Everything's under this new Tory government, everything's changing.
Yeah. It's all this leisure time that we have now.
So I won't be able to fit them all in here, so some of them will actually go into the next podcast. Anyway, let's kick off with Matthew Williams, who says, "With all this talk about the Debian release cycle being too long, I'm surprised that no one mentions the fact that you can run Debian as a rolling stable distribution. Jesse is the current stable release. However, if you go into sources.list and replace each instance of Jesse with stable, you'll be on a stable rolling release. As newer packages get deemed stable by the Debian team, you'll receive the update. Because Jesse is a snapshot, it may or may not receive the same update as a backport."
That's brilliant. Yeah. I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either. I knew lots of people run Debian testing because you get newer packages, but it's still fairly reliable. But I guess, packages at some point are marked as stable as they go ahead and prepare Debian, 9?
That's a really good find.
Yeah, I'd like to investigate that more. That's a neuron that's masquerading as a find. Then we have Henry Sprog, who says, "Not sure if you would class this as my neuron vocalizing, a candidate for Voice of the Masses, or just the ramblings of the befuddled. I first used Linux back in 97, have been totally Linux on my own machine since, about 2006. And over all this time, I've listened to and read so many arguments on what is free software, and why did we not call it Libre, with the expectation that we would clear up misunderstandings. But in all my time listening and reading, I have never heard it suggested that we use an acronym, which is surprising in a field that revels in the use. So here is my thought on what we should use, which only requires the capitalization of three letters." Well, four letters it should be. "Free software stands for Freedom Respects Equal Entitlement, or Freedom Requires Equal Entitlement, or Freedom Requires Equality Everywhere." Thanks, Henry. It's a noble idea, but I think the problem is when we add more potential confusion and complication into these things, then it just leads to more questions. Explaining it is hard enough. It reminds me of, like, Richard Stallman is very good at expressing the benefits of free software, and he often talks about the four essential freedoms. But I've seen him do being interviewed on mainstream TV and radio, and he starts talking about freedom zero, counting them from freedom zero to freedom three. That's a sort of nice little geeky in joke for C programmers, but to the widespread public, they just think, what is this guy on? You know, what does it mean? So, yeah, I think explaining freedom, free software in terms of freedom is important. But if we start to try and make acronyms and doubly recursive acronyms, then, yeah, I where will it end up? It's interesting. I did ask Richard Stallman myself about this a few years ago. You know, why call it free given the ambiguity? And he said, yeah, he would have given it another name.
I remember you saying that at the time. It's difficult. I think we've all thought about it. We all understand the problem. I'm not a fan of Libra either. I think that it's difficult to say for most native English speakers, but also people won't understand the meaning of it straight away. I don't know. Maybe it's quite a good question to ask Voice of the Masses or something. You know, if it wasn't free, what should it be?
I'd be very much in favour of freedom software. Just it gives you freedom, and of course, such a word is very popular in America. You know, if you put freedom in front of anything, it will instantly sell like hotcakes.
Isn't that what French software used to be called?
Yeah. So, and the final one then is from our Spanish friend, whose name I can never pronounce, Javier Arante Ruiz. It says
sounds awesome.
It says GUI at the end of his name, so it's a very computing-related name. He says, "Sorry for my bad English. I'm Spanish. Please be kind. I participated in the crowdfunding and never thought that Linux Voice would be so good. Keep up the good work. My first exposure to Vim was in 1993 or so. It didn't go well. In fact, it went very bad. I hated it so much that I promised myself that I would never use it. Some months ago, I watched your video about Vim, and the idea that Vim commands were like a language with verbs, adverbs, and nouns was very intriguing. I tried to learn Vim again. Now it's getting better. Why? Because I understand that learning Vim is like playing Zelda on a monochrome 8-bit Game Boy. It's a quest. You are not trying to save a princess. Here you want to master text editing. The game is long, fun, frustrating, and very rewarding. I have to say that the graphics could be better, but you don't play Zelda in an old Game Boy for the graphics. You play for the story. And sometimes you find a diamond. My last diamond is using DAS or YAS to cut or copy a sentence. I know there are many more diamonds to be found, but I've just started my quest. Mike, thanks for showing me the beginning of this quest."
That's awesome. And totally reminded me, do you remember, I think it's vim-adventures.com, which really is a game that you play by using Vim shortcuts to control the characters.
Yes, it's a top-down RPG in the classic sort of 8-16-bit style.
It's a brilliant way of learning. I played it for like a few days in our old job and learnt loads of commands, but immediately forgot them.
I particularly like this neuron because it references Game Boy Zelda, which I think is one of the best games ever, given the limitations of the device.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, did you play it, Graham? Link's Awakening.
I did. Yeah, I loved it. Absolutely loved it. Yeah.
Brilliant, wasn't it? It was all very sort of sinister. The world, wasn't it? No princess saving. And here's an interesting side fact: a big inspiration for the game was Twin Peaks.
Yeah, oh, yeah, really? The world of Twin Peaks influenced the game's director in the environment he created and the characters, and they all been slightly odd. And
that's surprising, yeah. Because I just put it down to cultural differences and that kind of thing. But in fact, there's no cultural difference at all. It's David Lynch.
Yeah. Whereas all the other Zeldas have been about rescuing the princess and stuff. The Game Boy one, all about a dream and stuff, is very odd. Anyway, that's enough for this episode. We have a few more next time, and anybody else can email me, mike@linuxvoice.com.
That brings us on to our Voice of the Masses, which is probably the most predictable Voice of the Masses we've ever had. So, the boss of Microsoft used to be that big sweaty fella, and now it's a new fella who is apparently a bit more friendly towards Linux and open source. Microsoft is embracing the Raspberry Pi. Windows 10 is the only Arduino certified operating system, And there is now a native Linux version of Microsoft's Visual Studio
Code. Yes, there IDE. Is. And I actually meant to mention this in the news, but if I can just interject here. Yeah, yeah. Microsoft has released this code editor for Windows, Linux, and Mac. They say it's geared towards building web applications, ASP.NET and Node.js, but it will handle other languages as well. And this is a really fascinating move by Microsoft, because this is not some small, you know, corner case application that they don't really care about, but they're throwing out there to say, hey, we love Linux. This is one of their flagship programs. Lots of people really love Visual Studio, and that plus Office plus Windows are like the big trio of applications and software stacks from Microsoft. So, yeah, it's pigs are flying in a cold day in hell and stuff.
That the Eagles have got back together. So we want to know whether you think this is part of a bona fide thawing in Microsoft's approach to Linux and open source, or whether all this manoeuvring could be yet another marketing campaign capitalizing on the current strength and success of free software. In short, can we finally trust I've seen comments. Everyone says no. No. So I don't know. I don't know what we could.
So that's it. Lunchtime.
Now let's go into a wee bit more detail. So Arab Islander says, "Well, the next Winter Olympics do have a good chance of being held in Hades. If they would care to make a bid, we would do well to remember the price of freedom is eternal vigilance." All true. Well,
World Cup football in Saudi Arabia.
Oh no.
It could happen.
Mark says, no, their business model, objectives, values and culture have not and will not change. If they can destroy Nokia, they can destroy the Raspberry Pi and any other risk they perceive to their market. Glenn Homer says, they can start their long journey towards being trustworthy when they stop patent trolling Android. Fifth each, in short, no. Everything senior management do at Microsoft is intended to increase profitability of the company. If they didn't do this, it would be a dereliction of duty to their shareholders.
Dale McGee, embrace is just a first step in embrace, extend, extinguish. Those who think we're seeing a new touchy-feely Microsoft would do well to read The Scorpion and the Frog. Dizzy Lizzie says, we are the Borg, you will be assimilated. Resistance is futile. Stephen Wheeler comes back to that point, a company's first obligation is to be profitable. But then, you know, if they can be profitable by being nice to free software, then why shouldn't they?
Yeah, I think it's a bit more complicated, isn't it? It's like they're offering Linux on their Azure cloud platform, and I don't think that's necessarily an attempt to extinguish or embrace and destroy Linux. I think it's just they know Linux is really, really popular, so they're going to use it. It's going to make more money for them if they offer Linux as an option. Yeah, I'm still very skeptical about them. I don't really trust the company yet. It will take many years to undo a lot of the damage it has done. But yeah, I think the new boss has just sort of seen Linux as part of this world. There's no getting away from that, and it can't be easily embraced and extinguished like proprietary products they can just buy. So I think they recognise that it's got to be a part of the future.
I must admit, I was quite surprised. I mean, I suppose I expected everyone to say no, we can't trust Microsoft, but I was surprised at how strongly people still felt about whether we can or can't trust Microsoft. I thought there would be a little bit more I don't want to criticize it. I think it's right to be deeply cynical of what may be changing at Microsoft or their new attitude, but what I'm surprised at is that everybody still feels so strongly about it, and things that have happened in the past haven't been easily forgotten by the people in the community. The community in general is willing to live and let live on many, many things, but on Microsoft and its past and the many things that it's done, it seems like those wounds still run deep, and Microsoft's got a huge challenge on its hands if it's going to try and properly embrace open source as the totally legitimate, brilliant thing that it is.
Yeah, I think, as you know, celebrating Debian's release with a cake like they did and releasing a code editor, that's sort of like interesting baby steps. But,
yeah,
you know, if Microsoft really started funding development of some core free software projects or libraries that I'm sure are used in some of their projects, then.
Or just, you know, altruistically helping developers fly to conferences and stuff like that, no strings attached.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Then I think that would, there are some sort of moves they can make that would be beyond PR. But like you say, Graham, the scars and the wounds run deep, especially for people who were like us, involved in computing in the 1990s. You know, that it was really, really bad times, late 90s, early 2000s. And we maybe we find it a bit hard to forgive, but... I mean, the new CEO of Microsoft has only been in the hot seat for, what, 1 year or so? It's going to take a long time before the old sort of Ballmer-ish, Steve Ballmer-ish Linux is a cancer mentality finally disappears.
I think it's hard to trust any company that's a monopoly or a near monopoly. I don't trust First Great Western. You know, for no reason other than that they just dominate the service in that particular area.
Yeah, and there are so many examples. It's not even worth going into it. But I do think it marks an important shift in Microsoft's strategy from 5-8 years ago, trying to kind of win market share out. Over and above Linux and open source, try and knock it out, to now kind of assimilating it and making it part of their kind of product, making it part of their strategy. So in a way, it's like open source and Linux as one, you know, and Microsoft now sees it more as business revenue potential and part of its growth strategy rather than for any other reason. I'm sure if it's given half a chance and it can take it out, I mean, then it will. Because that's what big companies do.
Yeah.
That's what they have to do. That's what they need to do for their shareholders.
Back to the comments. Sultan of Swing says, I wonder if Microsoft's attempt to bolster itself by edging closer to open source is akin to political parties creating coalition governments because together those strength in numbers. The problem with coalitions is that differing policies often cause rifts within, and Microsoft will need to prove that they have similar policies in order to get on with open source. That said, there are many companies operating both profit and non-profit organisation with differing products and strategies, i.e. Canonical, so I wouldn't criticise Microsoft for trying a different route. Can we trust them, though? I am willing to consider trusting them, which is more than I would have been a few years back. Coalitions very much last month.
Last month's news. Not much of a coalition, though, really.
Confidence and supply.
Yeah, I was thinking.
Oh, no. Anyway, Tony says no. Mr. MJ Burton says yes. I mean, no. Burgess Meredith, heavens no. They're just being evil under the guise of supporting open source. You know, like Google. Lucifer says Microsoft can be trusted exactly the same way Google or whatever other company can be trusted. Down the Electronic Penguin, being a company, profit is their only goal. Trust Microsoft, no way. No. No one says that we can trust them.
No one's even close to saying, well, maybe we should give them a chance.
Maybe we should give them a go. They seem like nice chaps. No one thinks that.
I think they're right. I think they're right. I think we've got to be quite hard and ballsy about it and say no. as much as I want to be kind of open and, you know, friendly, no.
Surely if Microsoft were to release some software under the GPL...
Which they have done. I mean, they used to be a huge kernel contributor. Not so much anymore, and that was purely for Azure compatibility.
Right, so that was only on its own... on its own terms for its own benefit. But if it were to... But the nature of the GPL is that you write code that benefits you or your company, if you're Red Hat or Intel or whoever, and then it's under the GPL, so it can then be used to benefit somebody else. There's no question of trust or not trust in that in that example, because the GPL enshrines the freedom. So yeah, so if the next version of this Code Studio were to be released under the GPL license, then that would be a massive step forward.
Yeah, yeah.
They'd still be able to sell it because they could sell the binaries. You know, they wouldn't lose money. They'd gain an awful lot of kudos.
Yeah, yeah.
Which would help them the next time they try and slip in something evil.
I also noticed that Mark Shuttleworth, I think it was at a keynote just last week after Microsoft's big Build conference, said that he thought that Microsoft, I don't know if he used the word copying, but he said Microsoft's aiming for convergence of apps on their tablets and their phones and their computers in the same way. In fact, I think he even said copying, that they're copying Ubuntu, but Ubuntu's going to get there first. So, I mean, linking it back to Linux, that's an interesting thing for Mark Shuttleworth to say. And he also said that they were open to conversations with Microsoft. I think he's sensing some kind of change in Microsoft's strategy. But also, purely from an Ubuntu perspective, I like the way that they're back on the convergence track, that those demos on YouTube of the Ubuntu phone windows and things moving from desktop to phones is really good.
Is Ben hunting wild haggis or something?
I'm not sure.
Or fracking for iron brew.
So that's it. We'd just like to thank you all for listening to the podcast, and we'll see you all again in 2 weeks' time. Thank you.
Yeah. Bye-bye.